Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengrabe. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. As all of you know, my goal at the library is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when successful, to make it levitate. I'd like to take one moment to acknowledge that we lost one of our very precious trustees yesterday, Robert Silvers, the editor of the New York Review of Books. After the conversation tonight, Lawrence Krauss and Alan Alda will take a few good questions and sign books. Thanks to the continued generosity of Celeste Bartos and Manaz and Adam Bartos. Upcoming this spring season, to mention a few, join us next week to hear Anne Enright and Megan O'Rourke, later on Elif Batuman and Mary Carr, Colm Toybin with Louise Glück, Cory Doctorow together remotely with Edward Snowden, Noam Chomsky and Wally Shawn, Alec Baldwin, and also Anselm Kiefer. Some of these events are sold out, but standby tickets may well become available, so do try and come in. It is a pleasure to welcome Lawrence Krauss after many years of speaking to each other over the phone. I'm pleased to welcome him in the flesh, live from the New York Public Library. Lawrence and I share a passion for Werner Herzog, who I speak to at least once a year to remain sane. I just saw Lawrence Krauss a few days ago. He's featured in a recent film by Herzog, Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World, a documentary on the internet and much more. If you have not seen it, do. It is a pleasure to welcome Alan Alda to the stage, who since acting on MASH and The West Wing has devoted great energy and insight to promoting the importance of scientific research. I recall meeting Alan Alda on stage in 2000 or 2001, I'm not sure, after a glorious performance at the Mark Taper Forum, then run by the great and now late Gordon Davidson, in a play about Richard Feynman, QED. Following the play, we had a short discussion together so many years ago. Tonight, we celebrate Lawrence Krauss's most recent book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Why are we here? I really hope to find out. On Twitter, Alan Alda posted the following. In his new book, Lawrence Krauss says, "Dark matter is a little like Belgians." I'll ask how when we're on stage at the New York Public Library on 321. Having lived in Belgium, this is me now, for much of my adolescence, I really would like to know why dark matter is a little like Belgium and Belgians. So please enlighten me, Lawrence. Now, for the past 7 or 8 years, I've asked my guests to give me a biography of themselves in 7 words, a haiku of sort, or if you're very modern, a tweet. Alan Alda submitted the following to me: actor, writer, science lover, happy with uncertainty. Lawrence Krauss submitted these 7 words: discovered, I'm not the center of the universe. Please welcome them.
My dear.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. Oh.
There we go.
So, Lawrence, am I right? Didn't you say in your book that dark matter is a little like Belgians?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Where did you come up with that?
Yeah. So what the hell does that mean?
Well, we can do an experiment because, you know, I'm a scientist. So.
Right.
How many Belgians here? You see, this is the problem, okay? Belgians aren't inherently strange, but you ask a room full of people, are you Belgian? You'd almost never see them.
Yeah.
And so the point is that inherently dark matter is no different. It's like antimatter. It's not any different the normal matter. It's just you don't see it very often.
So I have a question. When you go to Belgium and you say that, how do they feel?
Yeah, I was in Belgium with Richard Dawkins once, and they didn't appreciate it at all, actually.
So I
asked how many Belgians there were. They all put up their hands. The whole thing went
crazy.
Yeah,
they all stood up. Yeah. So, I mean, this is an age when we're discovering things that nobody even imagined could be there, like dark matter and that kind of thing. And I'm really struck by how in your book you pay a lot of attention to the idea, really Plato's idea to start with, and then fleshed out by other people, that everything we experience is an illusion. I didn't have dinner yet tonight, and I'm telling you, it's not an illusion.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's an illusion.
What do you mean an illusion?
It's an illusion that it's filling you up. And because most of it's empty space, first of all. I mean, just the simple aspects. This table is mostly empty space. So the world we see at our scale is really, as science has told us more and more, is totally different than the fundamental reality. And the greatest story we're told is really that story of how scientists were dragged kicking and screaming against their will, largely, to discover that not only is the universe not designed for us, but the fundamental laws wouldn't even allow us to exist to were it not for a series of cosmic accidents. That the forces we've experienced that we think are so important in our lives are accidental remnants of the fact that some field froze in the early history of the universe. The fact that things that seem different are really the same, and that's what I talked about with Plato, I begin the book with Plato because he talked about reality sort of as shadows of reality, the people being the allegory of the cave, that we are all as if we're chained in a cave and only can see the shadows of reality on the cave wall. And what he said, the job of the, whatever you want to call it, philosopher, mathematician, was to figure out what was real behind the shadows. And when we look out, we're doing just that. We're seeing these shadows different things are really different manifestations of the same thing. Electricity and magnetism are the same thing. Einstein showed that space and time, which appear so different, are really tied together. And then the most modern versions of that have to do with the fact that there are connections between the forces of nature. But the fact that the particles that make you and I up and the forces that make us up are an accident, a cosmic accident.
That's why you have the strong force, the weak force, and the force majeure.
That's exactly. Those are three of them. Those are the three or the four forces in nature. That's right.
I want to get back to. I mean, this sounds like you're applying for a Supreme Court job.
Yeah, it was, I'm not.
I asked you a question. You went off on a tangent.
Well, I just want to say
this interests me. What's illusory about this? You know, I forget who the great physicist was who said there's enormous space in solid things, the space between the parts of the atoms and stuff, but just try walking through that wall.
Exactly, but it's what the reason it's solid.
It's an illusion that keeps being reinforced by our experience.
Exactly, but you know, our experience is myopic. We have common sense, but common sense arose because it helped us escape lions on the savannah. It didn't help us understand quantum mechanics.
Right.
And therefore, it's not surprising that the world on different scales defies common sense, because we develop these things based on our experience that help us make it through the day and make it through our lives on our human scale. But on different scales, the world's quite different. And the reason your hands don't go through this table is not that there's stuff there in the way, because it is only one part in 100,000.
Forces in the way,
forces. It's the electric forces that are stopping your hands from going through this table. And in fact, since you were Feynman once,
Feynman is, by the way, so famous because I played him.
Exactly, he was just a nobody. So
you know, he was hardly heard of.
Yeah, that's right. He was much funnier after you played him, actually. For example, here's one of the myopic things. Gravity is the weakest force in nature. Okay, now that is counterintuitive, because when you wake up in the morning, you notice gravity. You try and get out of bed. Gravity is the thing you notice, but it's far weaker than any of the other forces by an astronomical amount. And Feynman gave a great example of this, which he said. So, go to the top of stand. You know, to take a tall building in New York, okay? We could say the Empire State Building. Let's just do it. Take a friend with you, or maybe not a friend, and push them off. Okay, so it takes 300, 400 feet for them to go all the way to the ground. That's the entire gravitational force of the Earth pulling them all the way to the ground, but they don't even make a dent in the concrete because electric forces stop them.
Very good.
And so that, you know, the whole Earth pulling you, all that time gets you going, but that'll stop you in a fraction of an inch. You won't even make a dent in the concrete. And so you get a sense of the incredible fact that we're lucky that the Earth is neutral, otherwise we'd be crushed in an instant.
I love how these great scientists figure things out by thinking of men falling great distances. Einstein got relativity with the guy
elevators.
Falling off a building.
Yeah,
right?
It's falling. Well,
I guess that's a fundamental way of thinking of gravity is the experience of falling, right? It's like a bad dream.
Exactly. It's like a bad dream and falling forever. In fact, Einstein thought about that. It's exactly that. And, you know, and that's another misconception that people have about science, which I try and correct in the book, in the sense that first of all, that science is done alone by people in rooms, are just, you know, that it's all revelation, and nothing is revelation. Revelation has never led to anything, any knowledge, okay? It's based on empirical evidence. And even Einstein's Gedanken experiments, his thought experiments, were based on experiences, so he could extrapolate from experiences that he knew.
Sorry,
but
I keep thinking of Gedanken Good Donuts. I'm sorry. Even his Gedanken experiments were...
Were based on thinking. Once there was a paper, someone claimed they discovered a new force in nature called the fifth force. I taught at Yale at the time, and I was really disgusted by that paper, so I wrote a spoof paper and submitted it to Physical Review Letters. My department chair was very upset because he thought they published it. But I got several of my colleagues and, you know, because these people had analyzed an old experiment and claimed to find new evidence, which is an awful thing to do because you're not there. Unless you're part of the experiment, you're not there. And so I remember one of the footnotes was that I had claimed to discover a new force, and I said, we were also reanalyzing several of Einstein's Gedanken experiments.
Oh, that's great.
But do
you mean when you say it's an illusion? That there's stuff going on in there that we can't see because we're not that small.
It's that the world at that level and the fundamental world doesn't resemble in any way what we take for granted as the properties of the universe that we experience.
So we can't experience it as it is.
We can't experience it as, and certainly quantum mechanics we can't even sort of intuitively understand.
It doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
No, I mean it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense. That's because you survived because some guy didn't get eaten by a lion, and that's why your ancestors procreated,
right?
So they could make you.
But an example of how profoundly it doesn't make sense, but it's so fascinating because quantum mechanics is supposed to be the most accurate, can make the most accurate predictions of any.
When you apply electromagnetism and quantum mechanics, as Feynman did.
Yeah.
It produces the best theory in nature.
So my favorite quote in one of his books is a picture of, I think it's one of his diagrams, and he says, this is a proton, it's the opposite of the electron, right?
Well, it depends what you mean by opposite. There's a positron, which is the opposite.
Pardon me. I didn't mean proton. I know they both had a P in it.
Exactly.
So he says, this is a positron, which is, of course, an electron going backward in time. The of course part.
That's right. I actually have the pictures there. It was Feynman thinking about a positron acting like an electron going back in time that proved something that actually Dirac, who had first predicted positrons, by the way, thinking they were protons. So what you just said is a long history of distinguished physicists.
So I was thinking like Dirac.
You read like Dirac, exactly. So you should feel good.
I thought like Feynman.
Yeah. Dirac was Feynman's hero, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And he couldn't be more different. Again, I talked about the book. That's the other. There's so many misconceptions about science that are wonderful to dispel. But one of them is that scientists are all the same, and you couldn't imagine two people more different than Richard Feynman and Paul Dirac. Paul Dirac never spoke and took everything seriously and didn't make jokes. Yeah. And of course, Feynman was exactly the opposite. Yeah. But Feynman idolized Dirac. And, And, you know, and Dirac was very proud. As you know, when the first time he met Feynman, he said, "I have an equation, do you?" And Feynman was always very upset that he didn't. But
your book is so full of character and story, and that's wonderful because you're talking about the things that are hidden to us, the deeper realities, and you understand them in a way that I think only a mathematician can understand them. But you are able to put them into context of human story, which makes it available to the rest of us.
I think it's important. Well, thank you. But I think it's important that it is a story. And it's a very human story because, I mean, while it exists independent of whether we're here, and the universe doesn't give a damn whether we're here or not, and when we go, as we will, it won't make any difference to the universe. What I really think this is the reason I call it the greatest story ever told is that I think it is the greatest human story ever told. It's this amazingly brave intellectual journey full of twists and turns and biased people and people getting things wrong and looking in the wrong direction. Maybe you did this in the Scientific American things, but I don't know if have you ever seen that video where you're supposed to look at these people dribbling basketballs?
Yeah.
And of
have
course,
you all seen that?
Have you seen that? You should go online.
We're going to spoil it for you. Describe it. It's a wonderful thing.
So you're told to concentrate on how many people are dribbling or something.
How many times? You say how many times do the people dressed in black bounce the ball?
And so they're doing that, but of course during that in the movie, there's a gorilla walking through the thing, and no one ever notices the gorilla. That's the first time I saw it. I didn't. Yeah. And they since made it even better. So even if we spoil that one, they've done other things, all these things. They changed the color of the room. All sorts of things happen. But if people are focused on something, they miss something else. And
this is science. Scientists are people like that.
Exactly. And the science somehow transcends the people. That's what's neat. The method somehow transcends. But you want to shake their. You want to shake them when you're reading the book, I hope, because they had the right ideas and they were looking at the wrong problems. They were so focused on one of the forces of nature, the strong force. They had everything that was necessary to understand the weak force, and it took 15 years and an accident. Well, Steve Weinberg was driving in the car one day and he suddenly realized he had the right answer to the wrong problem.
But that's like a revelation. I mean, his brain came up with something that he didn't expect.
Yeah. Well, that kind of revelation is okay. I call that, you know, that's creativity. Actually, one thing that you once said that I think is one of the most brilliant things I've ever heard.
Whoa!
No.
Did we have a little quiet?
Yeah. No, it was really so beautiful because it captured things. And I don't know if I probably will paraphrase it, but you talked about how it was science and art, which both of us think are connected in important ways and equally important. And I wrote a piece today in the Scientific American talking about how to, quote, defend the nation, as our ridiculous guy in chief is trying to do, you don't take everything away that makes the nation worth defending, and which is not my line.
Well, we can show it in a minute. Yeah. But go ahead. But don't stop talking about me.
Yeah. Okay, exactly. Anyway, you said you were up there talking about this, and all these people were interested in art, and I think you said art requires hard work.
Rigor.
You remember it. You say it. And
well, art requires rigor, and science requires creativity. They're
That's
both
what I
known
love.
For the opposite, but each has a modicum of both.
Exactly. It was so brilliant because you really, what's wonderful is you cause people to be jolted. It's exactly what science does. You take people out of their state of comfort and suddenly realize, wow, this is seeing the world in a new way. And that's why, to me, science and art and music and literature are the same. Science suffers, in my opinion, because it produces good technology. Because then people ask me, you know, what good is what you do?
Because as you said, it doesn't make a toaster.
Yeah, it doesn't make a better
these
toaster.
This deep understanding of nature that you're a part of finding is basic science. And basic science gets a bad rap because you can't make telephone calls on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, eventually you can.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. I mean, my favorite example of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that without Einstein's general relativity, we wouldn't be able to carry a GPS system in our pockets. Probably everybody here tonight has one in their cell phone.
We use general relativity to get around the world. I remember I actually wrote a piece in the in, I think it was the New York Times, on that, because I was stuck in traffic in LA, and I was realizing that, yeah, general relativity every day. And not just that, we also make calls on particle physics in another way, because the World Wide Web, which we all rely on, was developed at CERN, which housed the Large Hadron Collider, because the physicists, thousands of them, wanted to be able to communicate without worrying about sort of what the source of the information was, which is one of the problems now, is that, it has become come back to haunt us.
Yeah.
In the internet, no one knows if you're a dog, as they say.
Right, I love that. But there are some people who complain, and probably rightly so, that to say that 100 years later we're benefiting from Einstein's discoveries about relativity in a practical device, no matter how useful it is, it in a way denigrates the idea that the knowledge itself, for those 100 years before we knew how to make it practical, it was a beautiful thing.
That's the problem with science, because it makes practical things. But rarely do I hear people saying, what good is a Mozart concerto? What good is a Picasso painting? What good is Shakespeare play?
Yeah.
Because, and to me, I think the greatest legacy of science, and I really mean this, is not the technology, is its role in our culture, just like art, music, and literature, because it causes us to reassess our place in the cosmos and see ourselves in a new way. That's why what you said was so brilliant.
Oh, thanks.
Coming back to it. Because it causes people to suddenly reassess. All these artsy, fartsy people in New York say, oh, the arts are creative and science, they're just nerds just doing.
Yeah.
And that caused people to say, what? Science, creative, art, rigor? That's not the way I think. And I love that kind of juxtaposition that jolts people out of their comfort zone.
Well, when you're painting, when a painter is painting, not just any color will do. In a lyric, not just any word will do.
Exactly.
And think of the precision of a dancer, the rigor, the as you said, hard work to get to the point where you could translate technique into something unspeakably beautiful that's expressive of something that you can't put into words. All of that takes rigor. And the scientist figuring out what this little bit of data could possibly mean, and then being able to test it, that takes creativity.
It often does. It takes being able to think about things in a new way. But what makes it a little easier, in my opinion, for the scientist, is that we're guided by nature. So if you locked a bunch of theoretical physicists in a room and let them out 20 years later, first of all, it would smell pretty bad. But secondly, the picture they'd have of the universe is completely different than the picture in which we have, because nature keeps surprising us, because the imagination of nature is greater than humans. We would not have invented the picture that I describe here if we constantly hadn't been prodded by nature. There are things we just would never have imagined. And so we're aided by the fact that we're surprised all the time, that we have these tools that open up new windows, and you open up the window and it's just totally different.
You don't have to be a scientist locked in a room for 20 years for it to be unfamiliar. Most of us can't keep up with you and the other brilliant scientists who are discovering stuff that nature is made of that is hard to understand. We can't even understand the idea. I mean, does an electron really spin? Does a smaller particle, an electron, really spin, or is that just a word you gave it, like the crazy words you've given quarks?
Well, yeah, Murray Gell-Mann gave those crazy words for quarks.
Yeah. But what about spin? Is something really going like that, or is it as if it were, and it can be described mathematically as though it has momentum?
Anytime, I think I may even quote T.S. Eliot there about words failing, but I mean, it is true that the only proper explanation is a mathematical one, and electrons behave like they're spinning. But obviously, classically, it's
why
impossible.
Why do you say spinning? What?
They have angular momentum. That means, you could make a little electron bicycle, and your wheels go around, it has angular momentum, and that causes, that meant if you put a force this way, you could turn on the bicycle. The same kind of thing would happen for an electron. In fact, we use that in something called magnetic resonance imaging. We give a little twist to the electron, it torques around and starts to do this. And that's the principle that you use if you've ever had an MRI. It's that principle. The electrons in different materials, when they get torqued by a magnetic field, process in a slightly different way depending upon what materials are around them, and that allows us to see what your body's made of.
So they're really spinning.
They are. Yes. The answer is yes and no. I have to say, I'm in another Werner Herzog movie, and one of my favorite lines, he has me say yes and no. But I only as it, and he made me practice that about 20 times.
I loved the director. I think he was Hungarian in the movies. He used to say, "That was perfect, but we can fix it."
That's right, exactly. Werner, that's what's Werner. But the reason it isn't quite spinning is because it's impossible. Because an electron has no, as far as we can tell.
No mass.
Well, it has mass, but it has no dimension. It's a point.
It's a point.
So well, how can a point spin?
How can a point have mass?
How can a point spin?
I asked you first.
And what's really neat, to get back to the book in a sense, is that the electron doesn't have mass, if we're right. And none of us have mass if we're right, which maybe some people are happy.
Then we don't need the Higgs part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The right? Higgs part, if it weren't for this background field that's everywhere, and it's like swimming in molasses. It's a field everywhere, and some particles interact with that field and get resistance and act like they're massive, and the ones that interact with it more strongly act heavier, and the ones like the photon that don't interact with it at all remain massless. But if we're right, all elementary particles at some basic level are massless, and if that field hadn't frozen in the particular configuration it did, then there wouldn't be stars, planets, people, or anything, because particles wouldn't have mass, and it would combine. Look, I am going to show one image. We talked about whether I want to show, guess number two. Number two. This is something I learned from them. There we go.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this.
Yeah, okay. To me, this is the best representation, in some sense, of our myopia. So this is obviously ice crystals on a window in the wintertime. And they're beautiful and great. But let's say you lived on one of them. I would point at it, but all the screens are different. Say you lived at one of the ones that's going up and down. And you had a civilization on that ice crystal. Then you develop laws of physics. It'd be easier to move in one direction than another. And the physicists would develop laws of physics which would explain that direction was different than the other directions. And theologians would explain why that direction was special and why God intended that direction to be special. And there'd be wars because some people say that direction is special and some people say that direction is special. And people would die because of that. And the point is, it's just an accident. It's just an accident. And if you were on another crystal, it'd be pointing another direction. In a real sense, that is the universe in which we live, because if the Higgs field hadn't frozen the way it did, then electromagnetism wouldn't be a long-range force. We wouldn't have our particles wouldn't have mass. We wouldn't be here. All of the things that we think the universe was designed for us, many people do. But not only is there no evidence, it wasn't at a fundamental level. It wouldn't even allow our existence. It's not fine-tuned for us. It's just an accident that the Higgs field froze, and it didn't have to freeze that way. And just to add an upbeat note at the end.
It's liable to thaw. Yeah, and it'll all disappear.
Well, exactly. In the morning, that could melt, right?
Right.
And then the nice rotational symmetry will come back, but all the people would die. And in fact, what's really neat is our Higgs field may melt. It's just amazing thing is the mass that was discovered at the last Large Hadron Collider was just around the level that may make it unstable. And in the future, it could melt. Now, don't worry, because it's not going to happen next week or next year or in a billion years or a trillion years or even a trillion trillion years. If it's unstable, it'll happen a long time. But it could happen that the field melts and then all the properties of the universe that we see that make our existence possible will literally disappear, and the universe will be actually in some ways prettier, but devoid of life. And that's the fundamental reality. But all of this beautiful, beautiful stuff we see in this room here, this fabric of reality is just that. The ultimate picture is so different. And isn't it amazing that using the scientific method, these people who are biased and prejudiced and in many ways somehow made their way to discover this. And then we had the courage to build the Gothic cathedrals of the 21st century, the Large Hadron Collider, the most complex machine ever built over 50 years, just to test this idea, which could have been wrong.
Do you think the Large Hadron Collider is our one of our greatest achievements as people?
Yeah, but I just in the context of its time, I think the Gothic cathedrals were great when they were built too. They were built by thousands of artisans over centuries using the best technology available at the time. And this is our version of the Gothic cathedral, because those were built to sort of celebrate the glory of God. These are built to celebrate the glory of nature. Mm-hmm. And it's still 10,000 physicists. 10,000 physicists over 20 years from over 100 countries. And this machine generates more data each second, enough data to fill up 1,000 terabyte hard drives each second. More data than this is a wonderful library, but more data than is in this library and all the libraries in the world combined each second. And we have to somehow sift through that stuff.
That's one of the big problems, as I understand it, is they have to decide what to pay attention to
and what to throw out
and what to ignore. And in the stuff they ignore may be secrets of the universe untold.
That's right, because it takes incredible luck and somehow, luckily, knowledge to decide how to throw out most of the information. And you're absolutely right. Who knows? There's long histories in here of not only misinformation, but information that was in some ways discarded.
Well, it's what you were talking about bias. Mm-hmm. We're necessarily biased by what we know when we come in the room. And it takes a lot of freedom of thought, of, in a way, creativity, to go back to that. Before you get rigorous about how you deal with the data, I'm imagining that you have to be pretty good about saying, it seems that this is important because this is what we know is important. But Feynman went through that. Remember the story with the spinning plate?
Yeah, of course, exactly.
He was up in, it's an interesting story, and it has to do with what we're talking about, I think.
Yeah.
He was at Cornell, and he had been part of the project to build the first atomic bomb, and he was very depressed after it killed all those people in Japan. And he was not doing his work at Cornell. And one day he was in the cafeteria and he saw a kid tossing a plate in the air, and he could see as the plate spun, he could see it wobble. And he wondered, what's the relationship? Is there some mathematical relationship between the spin and the wobble? And he worked on it for weeks because it interested him and it got him a little bit out of his depression.
It got him totally. He suddenly had fun again because it wasn't fun anymore. He felt, actually, it wasn't, I don't think it was killing all those people that got him to depress. First of all, it was his wife dying. That was one thing. But for him, he was already recognized as brilliant. And because he'd impressed everyone in Los Alamos. Everyone knew he was a great physicist, but he hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
And he went there and he felt this incredible pressure, and he hadn't written any great papers, and he felt like a fraud. And it wasn't fun. He felt like he had to think great thoughts because he was supposed to be such a big shot. But
everybody else thought he had to think great thoughts too. He went to Hans Bethe, who was his mentor.
Yeah.
And he said, look, I figured it out. I got the formula for what the relationship between the spin and the wobble. And Bethe said, yeah, but what's the importance of that? He says, it has no importance.
Yeah, exactly. He was so excited that it was wasn't important and it was fun. And there's a lot of pressure.
Now, you're a good person to ask. He says that it led in some ways to what he got the Nobel Prize for. Is that just putting a nice end to the story?
I think Feynman did know how to make good ends to stories. And I wrote a book about Feynman that you know. I wrote a book called Quantum Man and his scientific biography. There are many other things that led more directly to his Nobel Prize. But what did lead to his Nobel Prize was the excitement of working on problems that he didn't know if they were important or not. Yeah. And that's a central part of Curie that we also have to recognize, and it's going to be a problem. It already is a problem in most administrations. It's going to be a problem in spades in this administration, because curiosity-driven research is essential. You can actually quantify this. You can show that 50% of our current gross national product is based on curiosity-driven research, fundamental, unapplied research that was done a generation ago. But there's such pressure now to fund only those things that are applicable and that have a direct application that it's a real problem, because what you really have to do is take people who are good and let them do whatever they want. And you don't know if it's going to be important, and you don't know if it's not going to be important. You don't know. People always ask me, what's the next big thing? And I always say, if I knew, I'd be doing it. Okay? Because it's a discovery. You just don't know. And and it's really important that we allow that. And I'm particularly worried I'm already worried. I don't know how much politics we'll get into, but even before this administration, one of the things that was being pushed by, at the time, the Republican the House Science Committee, in a disgusting way, was to say that you had to show how your research was in the national interest of the United States when you wrote a grant. I mean, and all you can say is now we can do the quote.
Yeah.
Okay, so
find out what number it is. This was Robert Wilson.
Yeah, who was the first director.
And what's the background of it? He was before a committee where they were trying to decide whether to fund a big collider in
Texas. The Fermi National Accelerator. No, not the collider in Texas. The Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Chicago. He was the director of it. And it was the largest accelerator in the world until the Large Hadron Collider, the most energetic one in the world. And he was asked by Congress, you know, will it aid in the defense of the nation? And this is just one of the most beautiful quotes. We both know it. Number 10, and I'll read it to you because you may not be able to read it on the screen. It says, "No, sir, I don't believe so. It has only to do with the respect with which we regard one another, the dignity of men, our love of culture. It has to do with, are we good painters, good sculptors, great poets? I mean, all the things we really venerate in our country and are patriotic about. It has nothing to do directly with defending our country except to make it worth defending." So it was his quote that I was stealing before. Mm. But and you should applaud good old Robert Wilson. So you should be able to defend all curiosity-driven research as being in the national interest in just that way, because it's going to produce what really matters in defending our country. What really makes us great is what we leave for the future. And if we stop doing the stuff that makes the future better than the past, whether it's in ideas, whether it's in plays, whether it's in science, or whether it's in civil governance, then what the hell are we doing here?
So, what is this symmetry and supersymmetry?
Okay, well, that was a good segue.
Yeah. No, it's something every time I read about it, I don't understand.
Yeah, well, that's good because we don't either. So let me preface it a little bit. So part of the greatest story is this discovery that led to the realization of how weird the world is with the Higgs particle and stuff. But like all great discoveries in science, as I think I alluded, they produce more questions than answers. That every time you make a discovery, there's new questions. Like, why did the Higgs field freeze?
Yeah.
The Standard Model doesn't tell you.
Does anybody know why it froze and why you expect it to unfreeze? About it that makes you think it?
Well, it turns out we know the what's called the potential of the field. We know the mathematics that governs it and what keeps it stuck where it is and the forces that it may eventually cause it to move. But we don't know. But we know that picture is just an approximation because the Standard Model, as beautiful as it is, doesn't answer the fundamental question of why the Higgs has the mass it does. It could have had any mass, and why it froze the way it does. And so we think we know that there's something that must be causing that to happen. And so that kind of question immediately get begged when you discover the Higgs. And what's a little weird is that the Higgs froze in a certain way, giving particles masses that they have, and that produces a scale in physics, the energy scale associated with this. It's a scale of energy. But there's another scale in the universe, which is the scale where gravity becomes a quantum theory. It's a much smaller scale of distance.
What?
Okay.
Can I
promote your new book? Because we do this again. What's the title of your new book?
It's about communication, and it's called "If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face?"
And that's exactly what I felt just there. I was thinking about that the minute you did it. I thought that's the title of your book. It's perfect.
And by the way, you gave me a wonderful blurb for the book. We're both in the business at this moment. My book comes out June 6th. And so blurbs are coming in. This wonderful one from you came in. I just want to read one for everybody to enjoy that you got from Eric Idle.
Oh, okay.
Eric Idle. This is Eric Idle's reaction to this book about physics. "I love the fight scenes, and the sex scenes were excellent."
Should I tell them?
I told Alan what really happened. My publishers didn't really want to put that in. And I said, no, you've got to. But Eric really actually had an additional phrase, which I said, would you mind taking it out of the blurb? He said, so the original quote says, I love the fight scenes and the sex scenes were excellent, but I didn't understand the science.
Great recommendation.
Yeah, so I thought maybe it's best you just have the first part of that.
So what about symmetry? What's
okay,
that?
Okay, so the bottom line is...
Want to understand something before I go home tonight.
No, it's good. Exactly. Good. But I confused you a moment ago. You may have forgotten when I said gravity is a quantum theory. So the point is that gravity is the weakest force in nature. So normally we can, on small scales, we can ignore it. You could never measure the gravitational force between two atoms. It's essentially, maybe never. It's so small that it's 40 orders of magnitude smaller than the electric force. You can't imagine an experiment that would allow you to...
Because you need a lot of stuff to sense the gravity?
Yeah, you need the whole Earth to sense the gravity. Fact that all of every atom in the Earth is attracting each atom in my body is the reason you can feel it. But two atoms, their gravitational attraction is so small that it would just be... It's so infinitesimal, you'd never be able to measure it,
right.
Okay? But it turns out if they get closer and closer and closer and closer and closer, if they get really close, if they get 19 orders of magnitude closer together than the size of a proton, then the gravitational force is suddenly strong enough that you have to start thinking about it. You can't just ignore it. In particle physics, we ignore gravity because it's just on the scale of particles in accelerators, it doesn't make any difference because it really isn't a relevant force. But you have to start worrying about the effects of gravity if you really want to understand nature on its very smallest scales. But since quantum mechanics governs nature on its smallest scales, if you want to understand gravity, you have to have a theory of gravity that is in accord with quantum mechanics. But general relativity isn't. If you try and use quantum mechanics to describe gravity, you come up with infinities. You come up with nonsense.
Right.
We don't know the answer to that question. String theorists hope that they might come up with the answer.
So this sounds like you're giving me an answer to a question I asked another physicist, and I didn't quite get the answer. It seems to me that we can understand things on this scale where we're in this room sitting on these chairs, but things are different when you get to a different scale.
And physics changes
with scale. So that it kind of depends on the scale you're at. Things can be true at this scale that aren't true at the other scale.
In fact, that's a profound fact as well, whether you know it or not.
Because I know it.
No, because it's really, this is a wonderful night for exposing misconceptions about science, because, and not your misconceptions, but people's,
right.
There's a notion that there's such a thing as scientific truth, and there really isn't.
Yeah.
Science can't prove what's true. It can prove what's false by experiment. But what survives isn't necessarily true. It just applies in a certain region. And in fact, no scientific theory applies on all scales. The best scientific theory we have in the world is the one developed by Feynman and others called quantum electrodynamics, the quantum theory of electrons moving around.
It's the best. Why?
Because it allows us to predict fundamental properties of everything in this glass that we could measure to 12 decimal places, even on atomic scales, and compare them with experiment and get it right to 12 decimal places. There's no theory, there's no science anywhere in the world that could, from fundamental principles where you could make a prediction and compare with observation to 12 decimal places and be right. So that's what we mean by the best theory in nature. It produces the best and most accurate predictions of any scientific theory.
So you were on the track of saying science it's not ultimately right.
It isn't. It turns out the quantum theory of electromagnetism, quantum electrodynamics, describes the world on certain scales, on the scales of atoms and smaller. But when you get really small, it's not the right theory anymore. In fact, it has to be unified with the weak theory and what we call the electrical weak theory because of the Higgs. So on a certain scale, quantum electrodynamics is perfect. On the scale of you and I, Newton is perfect. Einstein didn't supplant Newton. Newton is, again, let me give you another analogy that you may appreciate, because I'm sure you get a lot of mail too. So I get letters every day from people, a lot of them go like this. Everything you think of is wrong. And that's not talking about my politics. I get that too. But they're saying, and that's the first thing. Then they have this, I love this progression of thought. They say, everyone thought Einstein was crazy. Everyone thinks I'm crazy. Therefore,
oh,
Yeah. But then they start, and what they don't realize, everyone thinks Einstein did away with everything that went before him. And I spend a lot of time in the book showing that's exactly what Einstein didn't do. Because what satisfies the test of experiment today will always work. Whatever we learn about quantum gravity, if I take a ball and drop it here, it's going to fall, as Newton would have described it. So whatever we learn at the edges of physics, which extend the theory either on large scales or small scales or fast or slow motion, those will modify our understanding. But Newton's laws on the scale in which they were meant to describe things will always be right. And quantum electrodynamics will always be right on the scale of describing the interactions of electrons in atoms. But what we will discover is on a smaller and smaller scales or larger and larger scales, the world will be different. The forces will be different, and the theory will have to evolve.
Now, do I have it right that we understand how three of the four known forces?
Yeah, that's
known
the greatest
forces.
Story.
There may be other forces we may find. You know.
We may. We haven't. There's no evidence of them. I say, these people thought they found a fifth force, but there was the one I made the spoof of. But that was nonsense.
Right, right. So we understand how three of the four forces work together
as quantum theories, and they all look identical.
Now, if they can, the fourth force is gravity, right?
Yeah.
If they can figure out how quantum gravity might work,
yeah,
and cooperate with all the others so that they could have formulas that show how one turns into another under certain circumstances?
They could be. That's exactly the hallmark of great science. When things that on the surface appear different are seen to be the different manifestations of the same thing, that's how you know you made progress, and when different things become the same.
And this is what's called the theory of everything.
That would be called the theory of everything, yes. Some people modestly call it that. And in a sense, it's a
and
real
it's
misnomer.
Not a theory of
I hate
everything.
The name. It's not the theory of everything. That's the point. In fact, it's the theory of very little. Really. And as my friend Frank Wilczek likes to say, I don't want a theory of everything. I want a theory of something. It's really important because, you know, this question of quantum gravity is really from a basic perspective, profound and important because it will help us understand the origin of the universe. But to understand why oatmeal boils, it doesn't help at all.
Why biological
motors work in your body. You don't have to know of a theory of everything today.
Yeah.
The scale that it's relevant here is relevant for certain questions, fundamental questions we're asking about the nature of the origin of the universe. But quantum gravity is essentially irrelevant for knowing. Quantum gravity is relevant there, but almost nowhere else in nature, maybe. It may be relevant to understanding one thing, which is why empty space has energy. I wrote my last book about that. Empty space has energy. We don't understand why. And maybe if we understand quantum gravity, that might reveal something to us about that.
So
but I still haven't answered your other question, but we'll get back to it.
Well, what's the other question?
It was about symmetry and supersymmetry.
Oh, symmetry. Well, maybe this
No, we'll get there.
Yeah, because you're making me ask you this now.
Okay.
The thing about the book before this, about how something came out of nothing. What was the exact title? I'm sorry.
It was called A Universe from Nothing.
The Universe from Nothing. It sounds a lot like the universe that we got that came from nothing, where you have what is thought to be, I think, empty space that produces all kinds of particles that disappear again.
Yeah, virtual particles. Empty space is full of a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles that
appear.
Now,
is it full of them, or do they suddenly appear out of nothing and then go back into nothingness?
Well, then it's sort of like that electron spin question. So there's nothing there.
You're
going to
give me a yes and a no again?
The answer is there's nothing there, but it's really quite full of particles.
So when Feynman's father said to him, when you knock two of these particles together and all these other particles come out of them, were they all in there to start with?
That, you know, that's another great question because people don't mind the fact, look at these lights.
Yeah.
So what's happening is the atoms in those lights are emitting photons.
Right.
The photons weren't there in the first place. They weren't in the
it's
atoms.
Not because have to shine for a long time before the atom ran out of photons.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's no photons. The photons are created spontaneously. That doesn't bother people. But for some reason, people are bothered by a universe that's created spontaneously. I don't. No, I don't see a difference.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, I don't see a difference. It's no
easy for you. For me, difficult.
Yeah, well, no, but it's really the same physics.
Nobody knows that.
The universe, if space and time are quantum mechanical, then it's possible for space-times to pop into existence just like photons.
How do you know there's nothing? You can know something is something, but how do you know there's nothing?
Well, that's a good question. People say, well, you really weren't talking about nothing. And I made a joke that made philosophers and theologians angry because I said they didn't like it because they were experts at nothing. But the point is, it's not well defined. People who don't like nothing, the people who say you, for many people, and I know you probably don't want to get into religious issues, but for many people, their definition of nothing is that from which only God can create something.
Yeah, well,
that's meaningless. And yeah, for me,
I think you can probably believe that on the one hand, but on the other hand, say, well, what's under that? What if that weren't the answer? What might the answer be?
And you want to think about it, and you want to say, and the interesting way, the only way I can define nothing is the absence of something, because something is a physical quantity. I argued, and I do believe that it's sensible to say that nothing is a physical quantity. It's not a metaphysical thing, because nothing to me is the absence of something, and I can say very clearly what something is. And as a physicist, I can say there are elementary particles, there are forces, there's these things, but so there are different versions of nothing.
But you don't have an instrument to measure nothing. Anything you measure that gives you something means it's nothing. But you don't have an instrument that says, here is nothing. It's like saying, here be dragons.
Yeah, no, it's true. Except, and this is the real killer, okay? That is, in modern physics, the difference between nothing and something, there isn't really. I'm serious. It's just semantics, because
and he's got 500 pages.
Yeah. There aren't 500. There are only 300. But anyway, sorry. No, because that's the last book. Anyway, no, but because the point is that nothing could turn into something. That's what's amazing. Nothing is unstable. You take empty space. If you wait long enough, empty space will fill up with particles. Okay? And so this distinction between the void of the Bible, if you want to call it that, where there's an infinite dark nothingness, and a universe with 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, from a point of view of certain quantities, there's no difference. In fact, the reason I wrote that last book is the amazing thing is, if you ask, what's the total energy of our universe? The total energy, it turns out, as far as we can tell, to be zero. And if you were going to create a universe from nothing, what would you have the total energy be? And so once you realize that you could have a universe full of stuff that has zero total energy, then you realize it's not so crazy to have it come from nothing, which also had zero total energy.
Well, I just would ask the question.
Well, why don't you?
did you check that math?
I mean, you know, it's really... what I like about the picture, like I like about the standard model, is these are outrageous claims. They're outrageous claims. Yeah. And if we just made the claims, it would be religion. Yeah. I mean it in a less derogatory way than, well, normally I'm not less derogatory towards religion. Today I will be. So let me take the statement of the Higgs particle. So what I told you is that your properties are determined by an invisible field that's everywhere and can't be seen and is responsible for your existence. What does that sound like? Okay, but the thing is...
Yogananda.
And if it was just that story, it would be religion. But the point is we're not allowed to just make that outrageous claim in science. We have to say, if that field is there, how can we detect it? Yeah. And as I show in the book, the answer is sadomasochism. You spank the vacuum. You spank it hard. And you kick particles out and call them Higgs particles, and that's the way to do it. And the way the prediction that the total energy of the universe was zero, in a sense, we used to say that we thought the universe was flat. And by flat, I don't mean flat like a piece of paper. I mean like a flat piece of paper. I mean flat in a three-dimensional sense. Like, so it's the room, it's the world you always thought you lived in, where the X, Y, and Z axes always everywhere point in the same direction. In a curved universe, if you had the X, Y, and Z axes here and it went farther enough, it would be pointing in that direction somewhere else.
Raise your hand if you follow this.
There's three or four people,
okay. Okay, no, we're not. So we're okay.
No, it's
no,
very hard to
say it
to
again
picture.
Until it makes sense of us.
Okay, let me give you an example of a curved universe that you do know, the surface of the Earth. Okay, you take the line of longitude. Longitude is that way, latitude is that way. Longitude. They're parallel, right?
Yeah, until they go to the top.
But the top, they come together.
Yeah.
So these lines that were pointing this direction eventually point in that direction.
Yeah.
So that's clearly one way to know that the Earth is curved.
Right.
Okay, and it turns out in three dimensions, it's exactly the same. We can't picture.
You can picture because you know what these graphs look like. You have a familiarity with them. Most of us don't have that familiarity.
I can't picture a curved three-dimensional space. I can make two-dimensional space analogies. The mathematics allows me to do it, but I'm a three-dimensional being, so I can't really have an intuitive picture people for a long time tried to do that. And again, I wrote a book about extra dimensions once, and I was amazed that people in 1905 thought there were extra dimensions, not the ones Einstein invented, and Scientific American had an essay competition to describe what the extra dimensions were like, and they gave $5,000 prize, which was a lot in 1905 for that. But we can try and build up some intuition, but we are, just like going back to Plato, those people in the cave who only saw reality as the shadows of reality, for them reality would be two-dimensional. And if you told them reality was three-dimensional, they wouldn't be able to picture it. Right. The mathematicians would be able to describe what happened, but they wouldn't be able to picture it. And we're like that. We're stuck. And it's a limitation of our intuition.
Yeah, you have a wonderful chart in the book of an arrow.
Yeah.
And if the arrow were seen only as a shadow and we only saw shadows, the arrow looks like this. And then all of a sudden, from just the straight-on look, it's getting shorter. And it's getting shorter, and then it disappears, then it gets longer again.
That's what they'd see
when we're trying to understand
Length in special relativity. That's what we see. Yeah. Lengths change for us, and it's because we're seeing a rotated vision in a four-dimensional universe. We're three-dimensional being stuck in this four-dimensional universe, and when we look out, we see three-dimensional slices. And in relativity, the reason if I'm running relative to you that things look different, the lengths get shorter and time expands, is because you're seeing a rotated version, in a sense, in a generalized sense, of reality, and you're seeing a different perspective of that object. And so in four dimensions, there really is something called length.
See, what really interests me, as somebody interested as I am in communication, how we can get those of us who don't have the mathematics that you have to be able to come close to visualizing this. I mean, I went around the world once on a science program, and every scientist I talked to, I said, I can't picture the fourth dimension. And then one guy finally said, what makes you think out of 7 billion people, you're gonna be the one to do it?
it's great, I mean. And the point is, you'd be able to visualize it if you could throw a ball and it would suddenly go in that direction. And that's what we can't. And that's why the string theorists invent small dimensions so they don't have to talk about them. But because it's embarrassing.
So are you highly critical of string theory?
I have been. And my friend Brian Green, who lives in the city, I've been on a stage where I told him it wasn't yet ready for prime time, and he was very upset. But it is an extremely interesting idea, and I talk about it in the book. Well motivated, and with really well motivated, that has produced a great deal of beautiful mathematics. But what everyone, and Brian will agree, and other string theorists who are honest will agree, it hasn't yet demonstrated that it has anything to do with reality. There's real reasons to think it might, but it hasn't made that kind of breakthrough yet. So what I'm opposed to is hype in science. I mean,
say that again.
I'm opposed to hype in science because it always comes back and bites us in the butt. If we make claims beyond what we can do, then later on, when they're not validated, people lose faith in science.
Right.
And so it's really important that we point out what we don't know as much as what we do.
Along those lines, some people complain about string theory in that it's, at least for years, it's been very popular, and it's easier to get funding for studies in that than it is in other.
People complain for a long time because it was a sexy area. And science is faddish. You know, and it's true. Some people say there's a sociology of science and science is driven by fads. And that is true because scientists, as you pointed out, are people. Big revelation. Scientists are people. But what's wonderful, and that's really this part of the story that I tell, is that the science isn't faddish. So the scientists are. But when they get up against the brick wall is obvious.
Yeah.
And eventually, the rats leave the sinking ship. And that happened over and over again. It happened in string theory in the 1960s when it was trying to explain the strong force in physics. That the string theory is built, made, or originated in the 1960s to explain the force between what we now know as quarks. And it was developed to try and explain these weird things that we're seeing, and it didn't go anywhere, and it was dropped like a hot potato. And then 20 years later, people again said, maybe we've got the right answer to the wrong problem. Maybe we can apply it to gravity. And it was that was a revelation in 1984, and it was a fascinating revelation. But and because it got so fascinating, a lot of people worked on it, and yes, it got a lot of funding, and that may be a bad thing or a good thing, but eventually it has to, as a friend of mine likes to say, string theory is promising, and it's promising, and it keeps promising and promising. And eventually it's going to have to. The great thing about science is you just can't keep talking. You eventually have to show something for it. And it may.
Through that process of testing your ideas and being willing to be the first one to attack an idea that you think is promising, that is an exploration of mystery. As Einstein said, he said he wasn't religious, but he was a great admirer of mystery.
Yeah, mysteries in nature.
It's a beautiful thing. I mean, when you talked about the photons coming out of the light, that was to me a real moment of being presented with a mystery, that the photons are not piled up in the atoms waiting to come out when you open the door. There's something creates them, some interaction of forces on.
And quantum mechanics allows it to happen that they can suddenly spontaneously appear. And mysteries are what drive us. I was just talking to someone about that today. Another misconception about science, and I deal with this because you know I spent a lot of time trying to defend the teaching of science in high schools against people who would like to get rid of evolution and including our vice president. And the point, and it is true. I'm sorry, what they don't realize is they somehow think scientists like have these we have this secret handshake. Mm-hmm. You know, we all get together in a room and say evolution. Okay, and they don't realize that the way you become famous if you're a scientist is to prove your colleagues wrong.
Yeah,
we go to work every day and try and prove our colleagues wrong, because that's called learning, first of all. And secondly, it means that we've discovered something wonderful. That's what makes it a discovery. It was unexpected. And it's those mysteries that drive us. I really do think we just teach science the wrong way. We teach it as a bunch of facts, which that's part of the problem of alternative facts in this world right now. The science isn't a bunch of facts. It's a process for deriving facts.
And
it's the questioning. It's the questions you ask. Yeah. We should be teaching kids to question. Teachers should be doing questions in class, not answers.
And your book is full of that experience of questing, of being wrong. When a scientist is wrong about something, that's the most dramatic part of the story. And it mustn't be ignored. Most science is taught with all the wrongness left out.
Yeah, it's the final complete logical hole. And you miss the fact that it took a long time to get there. And there's lots of things that are wrong, and they're really great people who get it wrong and get it wrong over and over and over again. But being wrong is important. I mean, it's true for entrepreneurs too. Failing well I once created a program in physics entrepreneurship, which my business school dean said was an oxymoron, but it's not. Failing well is really part of science.
Samuel Beckett has a saying that I have on my desk and I see it every day, and it says, fail. Fail again, failed better. So I've been failing really well at understanding everything you said. But I succeeded in understanding some of it. But most of all, I'm exhilarated by the mystery that you explore, both in person and in books. We have wonderful conversations, often in front of 1,000 people. And it's really fun for me to hear your mind go like that. And before we leave, there are a couple of, as Paul said, good questions you might want to raise.
Yeah, let's go to the questions.
That this has brought to the surface. Is anybody?
Thank you. And they have to be good, because it is true. I love your questions more than anyone else's, because they really point out when I'm being
and ask
unclear.
A good question.
Now we've intimidated the audience.
Yeah.
Well, you can start with a few
bad
ones.
It can be just an okay question. Here's somebody. Oh, look, they're
usually it's the youngest person in the audience, but not this case. Okay.
What would be a good question?
That's the best question that can be asked.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. If you come up with it, you win the Nobel Prize.
Yeah. Good.
Number two, old guy. I have a question for Alan.
Good.
You've worked on communication of science. Since you've been doing it, what progress have you made?
Oh,
that's great.
In helping scientists to communicate better and now helping everybody else communicate better, we've made wonderful science. I say we because there's this all the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, and we have two or three dozen people who teach workshops around the country and around the world, Australia, Scotland, Oslo. And we've taught, in the past few years, we've taught 8,000 scientists, and we get wonderful testimonials from them. They go out and communicate both in person and in writing, and they're opened up, and the real them comes out. As your passion comes out, their passion comes out. The connection to the humanity of the people they're talking to talk to them as people curious to know and respond to that curiosity.
It's really true. First of all, I would say I know that because I've been with Alan and I've seen and talked to people who've been part of the workshops, and when Alan was in Arizona with me, we had a group of people who were utilizing some of the techniques, and which involve improvisation, and that's what
we
did here.
Yeah, we do an unusual thing. It's what we've been doing.
It's what we do.
When we talk, sometimes it goes off in a wild direction, but that always leads to something interesting. But we start by teaching scientists some of the basic skills of improvisation, not to make them funny and not to make them quick on their feet, but to get them engaged with the person they're talking to.
Exactly.
And that engagement, it's so interesting. Tonight when we were talking earlier, I looked more closely at you. I saw your eyelashes. I saw the colors in your skin that I hadn't seen when I saw you in a general way. And as soon as I did that, I had more connection to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And our conversation could get deeper. So that's, I don't make too long an answer
to
that.
No, but it is, let me just say that it is really one of the things that many teachers, and I talk to a lot of teachers as well, they're afraid to demonstrate their passion. Somehow it seems like it's not fair that they should explain what they're interested in. But if they don't, how can the students be?
But we're social animals. We weren't born, as you say, we weren't born in the savannah to do calculations. We were born
to be social.
We were born to be social, and we learn in social ways. If you just give people the solution and you don't give them the human way you got there, it's a little bit harder.
Absolutely.
It's a lot harder for many people. Some people get it the other way. We have different ways of getting it.
Yeah, I mean, everyone is, that's the other way. Is that, in fact, in physics, there are lots of different ways to understand things. And that's another really, and Feynman was big on that, that you can solve problems lots of different ways. And for some people, it'll seem natural one way, and for some people, it'll seem natural another way. And it can seem completely different, and you end up with the same result. And that's one of the beauties.
I've found it many times over that if you hear something from three or four or five different angles, there's a better chance you'll get it.
Oh, absolutely.
A whole other way of seeing it, of looking at it.
Yeah, and just thinking about it a number of times in different ways. I often tell my students the first time they see something, they don't understand it. Then the second time they say, oh, I've seen that before.
Let's hear some more questions.
A question for both of you gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming. I was going to ask this question to Neil deGrasse Tyson. I saw him speak on Long Island a couple months ago.
Well, you've got me, so you don't need to. Okay.
he spoke for about 45 minutes longer than he was allowed to, so they canceled the Q&A.
If he'd answer your question, it would have been an hour and a half. But anyway.
But I find my favorite quote to be quite timely, and I'm just hoping for your feedback. It's by Thomas Huxley. The struggle for existence holds as much in the intellectual as in the physical world. A theory is a species of thinking, and its right to exist is coextensive with its power to resist extinction by its rivals. Given what we're dealing with right now, I would love to hear your thoughts on that concept and theories that can persist.
One thing you said is really important, and that is what theory is. It's, again, in the public parlance, a misunderstanding of the word theory. And theory in science is something that survived the test, not just of experiment, but your colleagues. So something that's really works is something that's been attacked over and over and over again, and not just by others, by yourself. Something that Feynman said that was very important is when you do science, the most important person to question is yourself, because we all want to believe. And so surviving extinction is really the test of a theory. The fact that it survives a continual onslaught all the time by experiment and by theorists. And those things that survive the test of time, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's true in science. So that's my perception of what you, I don't know if you want to.
No. The only thing I would say about theory is it was a question I would ask you. I get the impression that the purest notion of theory is not a stab at how things work, but taking something that works and trying to figure out a way to express how it is that it works.
And express it with incredible rigor.
Right.
The artistic sense.
Not just a generalized view.
Yeah, it's not like I have a theory.
And that's the way it's understood. It's when they say evolution is just a theory.
Gravity is just a theory, but you can walk out the 12-4 window and test it if you want. Yeah. But
they won't do it.
Yeah, they won't do it. I try. I offer them all the time. But by the way, that is and I again got used to get flack for this from, but I used to say that the string theory is poorly framed because it's not a theory in the sense I know why it's called that, but it's not in the theory of the sense of quantum mechanics or gravity, and uh-huh. It really isn't a theory. And I think many of my colleagues, including Brian. We'll agree with that now. Yeah.
Thank you. We have to make our answers shorter, or we're going to disappoint a lot of people. Yes.
My question: understanding that, like, how when we see things from space, we're seeing it as it was back in time.
Uh-huh.
What I haven't understood is, since the Big Bang, has the universe expanded faster than the rate of the speed of light? In which case, that would mean we can't ever see back to the Big Bang. But if that's true, do we know how close we can get?
How long do you have? the simple answer is that, in fact, the Big Bang happened everywhere. So the fact that space is expanding faster than light, in the sense that distant objects are receding from us faster than light right now, and we can't see them, okay? And in fact, if the universe is speeding up, as I showed a long time ago, then the amount we see will decrease over time. Till eventually, in about 2 trillion years, nothing outside of our galaxy will be visible. The universe will be, essentially, it'll go back to the picture of the universe we thought we had 100 years ago, a single galaxy surrounded by a vast, eternal, empty space. But that isn't the reason, that doesn't stop us from seeing back to the Big Bang. Because the Big Bang happened at every point in space. It happened here, it happened there, all of the universe was in one place. And that means that the remnants of the Big Bang are everywhere, they're not just far away. They're here, and one of the really exciting things that I've written about and worked on is we can actually, by looking at one set of remnants from the Big Bang called gravitational waves, which we've just seen in a different context, the Big Bang created gravitational waves, and they should still be around in this room. And if we were able to detect them, and we have ways we think we might be able to.
We have ways of making you talk.
Yeah, exactly. We have ways of making the universe talk. That's right. And we twist it, and but the neat thing is, if we could detect those, we would get a signal from the universe at a time when it was a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second old. Not all the way back, but pretty good. And that would be an amazing discovery. It would push the lever arm on the, right now we can see back to when the universe was 300,000 years old, something called the cosmic microwave background. If we could see that, it would be 49 orders of magnitude improvement. That's never happened in the history
of
science.
Isn't there a big fog you have to get through before
That's what's great. With light, you can't get through the fog. You try and look back, but light interacts too strongly. But gravity is the weakest force in nature.
Oh, I see. Oh, great.
And so the gravitational waves can make it all the way from the Big Bang through the fog to us.
Far out.
That's why we want to use it. Yeah. Now, isn't that neat?
Yeah. Literally far out.
Yeah, exactly. Good question.
Thank you.
Hello?
Okay. You can play with the microphone.
Yeah.
There's a
bend.
There
we go.
Yeah.
Huh. Good.
I have to do that all the time, so I know.
That's what I didn't want to do.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to try to phrase this as a question because I know it's annoying.
Can you talk a little louder,
yeah,
please?
I'm going to try to phrase this as a question because I know it's annoying when people make statements.
Yeah, we stop
instead.
Them. Yeah.
So the light conversion, the light emitting as opposed to conversion is what I always end up hitting a wall with. People think that when you say, okay, it's something from nothing, it's an emission, they're always like, oh, there was something there and it got changed a little and now it's light.
No, that's not the way it happens.
Yes,
it exactly. Literally wasn't there.
So that is, do you know a way to, and I guess this is a big question, is there a physical force we can describe that people won't think, okay, there was something there and it's changed into, that's not something that they think of in every day, something that maybe could be a reference to a void that, even if it's not really a void, a vacuum or something
you're
like that.
Looking, you're looking for an analogy for this idea that something wasn't there but suddenly it is. Do you have one?
Yeah, well, I have one that came to mind, which is one that people ask me what it's like after you die, and I say, what was it like before you were born? So you have a consciousness. Where was the consciousness before you were born? Well, it doesn't seem to bother you that it was created when you were. It didn't exist. It certainly won't exist after you're dead, no matter what people say. And
there's no evidence for that.
There's no, I know. Yeah. Thank you. No, that's the point. I wanted to provoke someone in the audience to say that, and he did. But there's no evidence that exists. But your consciousness was created.
But
it wasn't hiding all curled up. You needed a confluence of complex systems.
You think it was?
That's a philosophical, like, well,
okay,
yeah.
Is that too philosophical
I'm talking
for you?
Something more like maybe, let's say you have a vacuum. Something that's not necessarily a void, but that when you make that analogy, people will think, oh, well, there was nothing there, and then something spontaneously was created.
Wait,
as
Paul
opposed
has
to something
a message
like a light.
For you. What do you?
No, we just can keep it short.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. Paul's good.
Paul wants you to get to the question.
I think the electron, for me, the atom emitting light is a really good analogy because the electrons were in those levels, they changed the levels, and suddenly something happened. And, I mean, I could give you lots of similar examples, but I guess I don't feel that they're any more intuitive or more clear.
But this is a great question you raise, and I hope it gets Lawrence thinking about someday when he's taking a shower or driving, it'll occur to him, wait, this is a great analogy for how something comes out of nothing like that, and I want to hear it when you send me an email.
I will, and you know, that's, by the way, I don't know if you've had this thing, but for me, I write books, and there are lots of reasons I write books. I think it's important to talk about science, but it's also a personal thing. I enjoy science, I happen to enjoy writing books, but what I get from it is I learn something. I know. In this case, I learned a lot of the history that I thought I knew, but I didn't really know. But what I really get is the requirement to try and make you not have that face.
Yeah.
And no, seriously.
That's great. That's great.
And so there are things in this book. There's something called gauge symmetry. It's an essential part of the book, which should be heralded. It's the most important thing in physics, but people don't know about it. I spent an incredible amount of time because I realized I never really. I know I tried to explain it, but I could never explain it.
Well, I wanted you to explain it tonight, and I never got to it. So next time we talk, gauge symmetry is
menu. Well, the neat thing is, by trying to explain it, I understood it in a way I never did before. And I realized that if I had thought of those things, I could have made a discovery that was made mathematically that I would have seen pictorially. And I never, it was neat, so it
and
was fun
And this
for
is
me.
So interesting. I hear this from the people that we work with, the scientists we work with, in communicating with more clarity and vividness. They understand their own work better after they do that. People are needing to go home soon.
So we just take one or two more?
Do you mind? I'm sorry, folks. We'll just take two more, okay?
Sure. Oh, yeah, I hate to do that.
Thank you both very much.
There we go. Okay, we're now having. Okay, there we go.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Thanks very much for your time. This was fantastic. I love the juxtaposition of physics, philosophy, the origins of humankind, and we're obviously living in a time of incredible technology, relatively. What are your thoughts on how we might optimize humanity going forward? Have there been any takeaways with all your research?
Optimize humanity.
I don't have the pretension to say I can optimize many, except we can optimize the way we behave. And I think the way we can optimize the way we behave, I think science has many lessons to teach us, which is to question that nothing's sacred, to question everything, and to rely on empirical evidence to test things, and to listen to others, to listen to different viewpoints, because you don't want to listen to an echo chamber, because you have to test many different ideas. So I guess I view the scientific method, which has worked pretty well to get us out of the morass, not to guide, not to be the sole thing that humanity uses, but we can all use it in everyday life, in the public arena, I think, to make more sound public policy, which is why I spend a lot of time talking about that, and to also learn how to have that wonder, that joy that Alan has, that he expresses so beautifully, and it's what drives me. I don't know if I express it so beautifully, but you look at Alan talking about something, and you just want to smile. and that sharing that joy. That's why I guess I called it the greatest. To me, it's humanity at its greatest. The fact that the Large Hadron Collider was built by 10,000 physicists working together. There's a lesson to be learned here. We can work together and have fun doing it. And if we could spread that more broadly, I think it would make the world a better place.
Thank you. One more question.
You can answer this one.
is nothingness potential?
Pardon me?
Is nothingness potential?
Absolutely. Okay. Namely, nothing has the great potential to make something. And in fact, if the ideas that I presented in my last book and to some extent this book are right, then nothing has the potential to create a whole universe, a universe in which you and I and Alan could have this discussion. And boy, that makes nothing really special, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, I got plenty of nothing. So thank you.
I love your shoes.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, my shoes. Thank you.
Great. That was fun.
That was so great, Alan.
Really fun. Thank you.